This is WKQX Chicago.
Autograph seekers are a little bit pain in the neck. I've had people actually sit down at my table and I said, I'm having dinner with somebody. Would you go? And they seem offended.
Her behavior. Coming home with changes of clothing several times. The bruised nipple that she had. And when I went to the school, they told us that it was because we were preparing her for a new baby. Well, there must be something going on at home, and blah, 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 and can we help you, and this and that and the other thing.
I wept. It was so beautiful.
I'm Marge Halperin on the Chicago Beat, where we'll talk with columnist Mike Royko, learn about the world's greatest collection of Impressionist art now in town, and visit Chicago's Jamaican neighborhood. But first, a look at the subject that strikes fear in parents across the country. Parents are talking to their small children about a topic that once had to wait until the teen years or later. The fear of sexual abuse of small children has grown as the number of complaints has grown. In Chicago, reports of child abuse of all types are up 38% this year, with sexual abuse leading the way. But despite the news reports and publicity surrounding this problem, a Northside woman we'll call Jane was not prepared for what happened when she picked up her 4-year-old daughter one afternoon last spring at the Jewish Community Center's Rogers Park Daycare.
I observed one of the employees at the daycare center tickling her as she was coming down the stairs, and she was saying, "No, leave me alone, don't touch me." So when we got home, I asked her why she was upset with this particular person, and she said that she didn't like it when he tickled her. I asked her where he tickled her, and she named a lot of normal places like her arm, her leg, and then I asked her, "Does he tickle you anywhere else?" And she said, "Yes, Mommy, my vagina."
Jane was quick to believe her daughter's story, but the director of the daycare center was not.
She made statements to me like children her age sometimes confuse their body parts. Perhaps one of the older children was playing doctor with her and she got confused. They also tried to tell me that we had been flooding our child with too much sex education at home, and that's why she was making allegations like this.
If Jane's daughter was telling the truth, it was a traumatic story. If not, she had a different, almost equally serious problem. Finally, Jane decided the story was too wild to be a lie.
It ranges from adults urinating and defecating on children to forcible rape, to sticking pins and needles in her vagina and in the penises of little boys on other parts of her body. 4-year-old children don't fantasize about this kind of thing. When my child fantasizes, she fantasizes about dragons and about ghosts. She doesn't fantasize about a teacher sticking a needle in her vagina. And I think this is just not part of a 4-year-old's frame of reference.
Close your eyes, have no fear. The monster's gone, he's on the run, and your daddy's here.
And that was the beginning of months of police investigations that have led to the indictment of the center's janitor and may end in charges against others, since interviews with 88 children show as many as 50 may have been abused, with perhaps 15 adults involved. But Assistant Cook County State's Attorney Irv Miller says there may not be any further charges, since small children don't often make good witnesses.
My first question is, do I think the person did it? Well, if I say no, the investigation doesn't go any further. Mm-hmm. If I say to myself yes, the next question that has to be answered is, can I prove it as a prosecutor, beyond a reasonable doubt? If I say no, I can't charge somebody. If I say yes, I do.
Parents say their children are now being victimized by the legal system, but Miller says no one is served by going to court with a weak case.
Put your young child
through the rigors of cross-examination and have that child see success is not going to be there, it could be self-defeating. Putting the case in and having a judge say not guilty is not going to do that child any good.
Heart tell the truth when no one wants to listen, when no one really cares what's going on. It's hard to stand alone when you need someone beside you. Your spirit, your faith must be strong.
With the Rogers Park case hanging in legal limbo, the families involved are putting their lives back together. Linda is trying to look forward, but can't resist a look back at the signs she wishes she'd seen, telling of her daughter's abuse at school.
Her behavior, coming home with changes of clothing several times, the bruised nipple that she had. And when I went to the school, they told us that it was because we were preparing her for a new baby. Well, there must be something going on at home and blah, 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 and can we help you and this and that and the other thing.
Jane thought she was preparing her daughter with a TV show about child abuse, but she says other parents sending their kids to school or just to the babysitter should have a heart-to-heart talk first.
Just to explain to their child that her body is private, or his body is private, and that no adult is allowed to touch the child in a way that makes the child uncomfortable, and that the child has a right to say no if an adult touches her or him in a way that the child doesn't like. The child should say no, and I think parents should assure their children that if anything like that ever happens, they will be believed, and they will be protected, and they will still be loved.
Then, on your own, check out the school or home your child will visit. Jane and Linda say it's not enough to rely on reputation, as they did with the Rogers Park Center.
It was licensed by the state. The teachers had excellent credentials. Many of them had master's degrees.
Right.
We had no reason to believe that this was a place where children would be abused.
But that doesn't mean it can't happen. It doesn't mean it can't happen, and that's why you must be very observant of your child's behavior and listen to what they say, because it can happen anywhere.
One last piece of advice from Jane. Try to see daycare life through your child's eyes.
When I think of the times I left my daughter at the center and my parting words to her were, do what your teacher tells you, be a good girl, behave yourself, I could cry now when I think of those times. What I should have said was, enjoy yourself. Have fun.
Mike Royko has been churning out a daily newspaper column for 20 years, these days for the Chicago Tribune and about 200 other papers around the country. He's now peddling a new collection of his columns, a book called Like I Was Saying. And as we talked about that recently, it became clear that the more Royko writes, the bigger a celebrity he becomes, and the less he likes it.
That's not why I went into this business. It's not why I wanted to write a column. That's not why I became a reporter. And I don't like it for myself. I don't like it for other people who are visible in the news business. I've seen it happen with television anchormen who occasionally go out and cover stories where they... the people they're covering are asking them for their autographs. No, it's just not a lot of fun. I went to the two Cub playoff games, and I was there to write about them. I was there in two capacities, one as a fan and the other to write about it. And I couldn't move around and talk to people if I wanted to because there was always somebody rushing up to get an autograph. Autograph seekers are a big pain in the neck. I've had people actually sit down at my table. I said, well, I'm having dinner with somebody. Would you go? And they seem offended. Well, we thought you were a nice guy. Well, I'm a nice guy. You know, I'm here with friends, and I didn't invite you. I don't know you, and I'd rather not have dinner with you if it's okay. Why do I tell everyone what a jerk you are? And I can't explain it. It's all part of the whole celebrity madness in this country.
I wonder how much your role as a defender of the little guy might have been tarnished when you switched to the Tribune and your contract was publicized, showing that you made something like $1.3 million. You had membership in a country club.
Over what period of the contract? And what period was that?
Now I'm trying to remember. 3 years.
Five years. Well, I didn't hear anybody mention it when I was I was writing five columns a week and making $173 a week. When the year I won the Pulitzer Prize, I think I was making something like $22,000 a year. Nobody mentioned that. So after all these years, I finally got hard-nosed and asked for some money, and everybody got all excited about it. I make probably what the average starting second baseman on a second division ball team in the National League makes.
What do you think about the Sun-Times now? You left with some extremely bitter columns. Some of the first ones to appear in the Tribune were aimed directly at Murdoch, and some of them got pretty tough. But now you've had almost a year to look at what he was doing to the paper. Is it really as bad as you expected? How is it doing, do you think?
It's not as bad as a couple of his other papers. But other than being a flashier paper, I see nothing convinces me that it's a better paper. I don't think it's a better paper. I think it's not as good a paper as it was. And most of the reasons that I left for were confirmed. They came in like a bunch of thugs and with total disregard for people who had spent many, many years working very hard on that paper, trying to make it a good paper. And they were abusive to him, insulting, in some cases cruel. And I wasn't going to work for people who were like that.
When you write your columns, can it be assumed that you, outside of obvious sarcasm, believe the things that you say? Or it would appear that some columns you write just to see if you can get a rise out of your audience, that column about what to do with small dogs, for instance.
Oh, I don't know if you get a rise out of people sometimes. I mean, there's... If Woody Allen makes a joke, do you ask him, do you really believe what you said in the joke? I think it's pretty obvious when there are times, and I'll write an essay just on a subject. I think it's fun. If people take themselves too seriously, I think that's a pretty good time to write about it. If I think a subject is funny, I'll write about it. And Unfortunately, society has been conditioned through television more than anything else to laugh when a laugh track tells them to laugh. Writing something humorous, presenting something humorous in the written form is difficult today because people expect something to let them know when it's funny. They turn on their television set, and if they hear the audience laugh, then they know it's time to laugh. They know it's funny. And for many people, that's the only way they know it's funny. So when you deal with written matter, unless you put in a line in parentheses saying, time to laugh, laugh at this point or something, a lot of people are going to take it seriously. They just don't have a sense of humor, especially if the butt of the joke might be something that relates to them. So if I write a column, obviously meant in fun, about little dogs, I mean, I really didn't seriously mean that people should tie a little dog to a stick and use it for washing windows.
You didn't.
Nor did I mean you should spray it with end dust and chase it under the bed. And people who thought that I meant these things in all seriousness, they've got the problem. If they don't realize that I just have a little fun with the subject, then that's too bad.
You're listening to the Chicago Beat. on WKQX Chicago Q101. Still looking for the perfect Halloween costume? Commentator Dave Jaffe has some tips.
You can have your Christmas and Thanksgiving, your Hanukkah and Flag Day, but for my money, the only holiday that's any fun is Halloween. I'm not talking about that, oh, isn't Billy cute in his Snoopy suit, let's give him a Snickers fun. Halloween is not for children. Parents nag their kids all their lives not to stay out after dark, or to wear constricting clothing, or to accept candy and money from strangers. Does it make sense to tell them once a year, hey, I was just kidding? Halloween is for grown-ups who can approach it with maturity and enjoy it with dignity. And stay out after dark, wear tight clothing, and take candy and money from strangers. You've probably received an invitation to a Halloween party, or if not, you know where one is you can crash. Keep in mind as you select a costume that as an adult you have a responsibility not to dress up dumb. He-Man or a Smurf does not cut it. Likewise, you should not waste money on overly exotic costumes like coating yourself with gold and going as the Taj Mahal. This is a time to test your creativity. The best outfit I ever saw was on a fellow who had draped himself in an enormous trash bag glued with gum wrappers and cigarette butts, put a miner's lamp on his head, and gone out as Lower Wacker Drive. If you just can't think up an award-winning costume, leaf through a copy of Time Magazine, which is chock full of ideas and not much else. Looking in the business section, you could sketch a grid on your chest, draw red and blue vertical bars, slap a dollar sign on your forehead, and go as a graph of leading economic indicators for the coming fiscal year. Or, if you want to keep it cheap, turn to the book section. The costume? A calorie counter in one hand, a grapefruit and a diet pop in the other, a jogging suit, and voila! You now represent 6 of the 10 best-selling nonfiction books in the nation. Turn to science and medicine. Then buy a pair of those great novelty glasses with the eyeballs that hang down on springs, slip on a hospital gown, grab a handful of carving knives, and go as the headline, Eye Surgery, Menace, or Something Worse. There's plenty more to choose from. The arts, living, environment, letters. But you'd better get started. The best costumes take a lot of thought, planning, long hours of building, and tedious attention to detail. My costume? I haven't decided, but I've narrowed it down to fireman or ghost. I'm Dave Jaffe on the Chicago Beat.
As the cold winds start to blow off Lake Michigan, it's time for the annual dream of an island in the sun. But if you can't afford a trip further south than Peoria, let Sandy Hausman take you to our own Howard Street, where anyone can have a taste of the tropics.
I chip some ice. I don't measure my milk. I just pour enough in there. I think that would be enough for the shake. And vanilla.
Behind the counter of a small storefront called El Dinamico Dallas, or the Dynamic Dallas, Armani's Dallas is making tropical drinks with mangoes, papayas, and guanabana, mame, and tamarindo. Those names sound strange to North America, but Mrs. Dallas is prepared with photographs from the fields and markets of Haiti, Jamaica, and other tropical countries.
These are what he's eating now, the green plantains. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and we take the picture so we can show it to them. Yeah. They like it, yeah. Okay. Now, this is breadfruit. I don't know if many people don't know that. It's breadfruit. Now, this is a goat. That's a, what does a goat look like? This is the market when we went to Haiti.
You think people don't know what a goat looks like?
You'll be surprised because a lady came here. She asked my husband, what is a goat? Is it a fruit? There is. They asked us if it's a fruit.
Goat is a house specialty. It comes curried or simmered in a sauce of beer, wine, green olives, and hot peppers. The menu also offers curried chicken, shrimp creole, Haitian pork, oxtail, and black bean soups. Or the adventurous eater can order a shellfish called conch or a strong-tasting kingfish described by the king of the kitchen, Chef Eric Dallas.
It's a very nice eaten fish, no bone to it, just a center bone, and it's all flesh.
Mm-hmm. Now, are any of these ingredients hard to come by in Chicago, the conch or the kingfish, for example?
No. Anything you cannot get in Chicago, you cannot get in the world.
Mr. Dallas hails from Cuba, his wife from Haiti, and together they help Chicago to discover a new and spicy cuisine. Lunchtime finds three workmen sitting in a corner booth, checking out the colorful Haitian art on the walls and colorful island cooking on the table.
This is curried chicken, And this is that plantain she was telling us about, and that's rice.
What do you think so far?
That's delicious. I haven't tasted the curried chicken yet, and the rice is real good. And I tasted his black bean soup, and that was good, too.
Yeah? Had you been here before?
Once before.
And what did you get then?
A taco.
You weren't too adventurous.
No.
For dessert, there's sweet potato pie, a crust filled with mashed banana, coconut, raisins, spices, and, of course, sweet potato. And if that doesn't float your boat, a short stroll up Howard will take you to the Caribbean American Baking Company, where the experts line up for a wide selection of sweets and snacks.
We're from Jamaica, and we like the Jamaican baked goods.
I like all of there, all of it. But my specialty is the carrot cake.
The beef patties and the auto bread.
You from Jamaica?
I'm from Jamaica.
They have some delicious beef patties. They have good fresh cakes and sweet rolls, and they have some good cola, champagne cola from Jamaica. It's really nice, you know, fresh stuff. It's really good.
Where are you from?
I'm from Puerto Rico.
People come from all over the Midwest, according to baker Doran McCullough. They buy the Jamaican hard dough and sweet coconut bread, and they feast on patties, flaky turnovers with a spicy beef or vegetable filling inside. The guisada is a small pie filled with coconut. Totos are little spice cakes flavored with Jamaican favorites, ginger, cinnamon, and nutmeg. There are bread and sweet potato puddings, plantain tarts, cookies, and cakes, all baked by Cynthia McCullough, who warns that her wares are not too sweet.
We don't have a lot of decorated, fancy-looking stuff out there because it's really sugar that you use to do that. They always said that people eat with their eyes. But what you have to do is come in and taste what we have, and then you won't eat with your eyes anymore. You'll just use the taste buds in your mouth.
You can use the Howard Street L to reach the bakery or go west off Sheridan Road. The American Caribbean Bakery is at 1551 Howard. El Dinamico Dallas is at 1506. Prices at both places are low and the quality high. So bon voyage and bon appetit. On the Chicago Beat, I'm Sandy Houseman. And now it's time to be a good sport, something Q101 sports director Pat Benkowski says Chicagoans have not been lately.
When the Cubs' Rick Sutcliffe made several references to feeling bad about not beating San Diego in the National League playoffs at his Cy Young Award press conference this week, it made me think about how unfair many of us have been to Chicago's baseball teams lately. Certainly the 1984 White Sox were a disappointment when you consider their American League Western Division championship runaway in 83, but even after losing to the Orioles in the championship series, the Southsiders were painted as losers. People, including me, said the Sox, since they split the first two games in Baltimore, should have won 2 out of 3 at Comiskey Park and moved on to the World Series. And when the Cubs won the first two games of the National League playoff at Wrigley Field against the Padres this year, expectations about the Northsiders' appearance in the World Series were as high as could be. I remember jokingly making plans with fellow press members about visiting Windsor, Ontario, while the Cubs were in Detroit in the World Series, a trip that would correspond with my visit to Tijuana, Mexico, during the off day at San Diego, 3 countries in 1 playoff. But the Northsiders were deemed failures, too, for not winning 1 road playoff game. In both cases, it just wasn't fair. Keep in mind, media and fans alike still got out to Comiskey Park between 1960 and 1982 during that team's dry spell. Even more notably, there was fan support and media support at Wrigley Field from 1946 to 1983, when that club plain didn't deserve it, and we should have just forgotten about them for the time being. But now with both teams under different ownerships, and with aggressive management teams who are willing to spend top dollar for star players, I think it's time to back off and instead take a harder look at the Chicago teams that have not finished in first place lately. I think you know who I mean. I'm Pat Benkowski.
When Claude Monet hopped a train from Paris to suburban Bougival, about the distance from the Loop to Oak Park, and set up his canvas to paint the passers-by on a river bridge, he couldn't have known that 115 years later, in Chicago, people would MasterCard Ticketron at $4.50 a crack and line up to see his afternoon's work. But that's what they're doing, and they include Dave McBride.
It was cool and crisp and crowded early last Tuesday on the steps of the Art Institute. More than 50 people huddled outside the locked front doors to be among the first to experience the one-of-a-kind exhibition of the landscapes painted by the French Impressionists entitled A Day in the Country. Richard Bretel of the Art Institute was key in assembling the show.
The Impressionists, if one is to understand them completely, were a small group of French artists who attempted to paint paintings which would be accessible to their contemporaries, particularly their middle-class contemporaries. They were among the first artists, the first major group of artists in modern art history to appeal to ordinary people as opposed to wealthy people and academicians and the government. And what therefore one has to do in understanding their pictures is to understand the world in which they lived and the audience for which they made those pictures.
And the audience for which these paintings were created is much like the audience viewing the Chicago exhibit, urban dwellers who measure their experience in the real rural landscape in hours. A busy Parisian could only find time for a weekend trip to the country via commuter train. And the Chicago exhibit is designed with a central starting point, the Paris train station. Visitors strolling from there in several directions to galleries representing the most popular suburban Paris locations.
The idea of the exhibition is to bring Impressionism back to France, to take it out of the context of the international gallery goer, and to reassemble very significant paintings, paintings of very high quality, drawn from all over the world, not by artist or by style or by date, but by subject, and thereby to recreate in the experience of the viewer of the exhibition an actual landscape, the landscape surrounding Paris and on the Norman coast, which was the landscape experienced on the weekends and in the summer by Parisians and painted by the Impressionists.
If the rural paintings of Monet and Pissarro and Renoir and the others began as art for the masses, those who massed in Chicago on opening day of A Day in the Country were impressed by the Impressionists.
I just feel very privileged to have been in Chicago just at this time. I'm only here for 3 days, and I am delighted with the exhibit.
I thought it was fantastic. I don't care for Monet art, but just the difference from his early paintings to the later ones, you can see an improvement.
Having just returned from France no longer than a month ago, a lot of the visual impressions that I had were reinforced by the things I've just seen at the exhibition.
I wept. It was so beautiful.
The exhibit benefits from the expert and insightful tape narration of curator Bretel, who passes along some interesting period trivia. For instance, prior to the Impressionist period, the French holidayed at the beach but did not swim. They considered it vulgar. But with the Industrial Revolution, columnists in Paris encouraged sea bathing as a way to cleanse one of the grit of the city. And thus, the French bathing suit industry was born. When we asked Bretel to suggest a period composer to play as an accompaniment to this story, he said, "Anything by Offenbach, but please, no Debussy. They always play Debussy with the Impressionists, and I'm sick of it." A Day in the Country, Impressionism in the French Landscape, through January 6th at the Art Institute. I'm Dave McBride.
That's our show for today. The Chicago Beat can be heard at this time, the final Sunday of every month. Thanks for joining us. I'm Marge Halperin on Q101.